welcome to eHistoria Medicine. I'm Dr. Ashwini Nathu. Hurry, worry and curry is a popular catch-all phrase that has been used to describe a number of lifestyle diseases. But before diabetes and heart disease became global health concerns, this phrase was coined in the mid-19th century for a very different disease. It was considered to be a lifestyle disease, one which was aggravated by hurry, worry and curry. This condition described here is peptic ulcers. Many of you must be wondering why we don't hear about them more often these days, especially since our lifestyle hasn't been more stressful and fast-paced in the history of mankind than it is now. So then, what changed? There was a polar change in the way we looked at the factors causing ulcers and the process of ulceration, and behind this change is a duo of doctors from Down Under. Before we get to know more about them, let's dive in a little bit into the history of ulcers. Peptic ulcers comprise of stomach and duodenal ulcers. Duodenum is the part of the small intestine which is placed immediately after the stomach. It was named so after the Latin word for the number 12, duodecim, since it was described to be 12 finger breadths long. The oldest incidence of peptic ulcers was described in 1984 when To Cheng found a perforated duodenal ulcer in a preserved body from 167 BC China. A pillar inscription at Epidaurus dating from the 4th century BCE describes a surgical procedure performed by Asclepius. Modern researchers believe it to be a repair of a perforated ulcer. Another historically important reference is from 1670, the death of Princess Henrietta, daughter of King Charles I of England. She had complained of stomach pains for a few days and is said to have collapsed immediately on ingesting a cup of chicory water. The suspicion was that she had been poisoned, but the autopsy revealed that there was a small hole in the wall of her stomach, concluding that it was an ulcer that had perforated the stomach. Medical historians have raised a possibility that at least a few of such alleged poisoning cases may have been a result of perforated ulcer and may never have been detected as no autopsy was ever performed. The symptoms of gastric ulcers like sore eructation, upper abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting and heartburn had been described by ancient men of medicine as early as 350 BC. Celsus in the early 1st century had recommended consumption of light and glutinous food along with the avoidance of any sour or acrid food. But in those times, the actual presence of the ulcers was never documented. Later, the ulcers, usually perforated, could be observed during autopsies, but no definite treatment could be done. William Beaumont had discovered the presence of hydrochloric acid in the stomach in the 1820s. Therefore, it was postulated that this acid corrodes the stomach lining and causes ulcers. And the more the acid, the more severe the ulcers and the more its complications. Around the late 18th century, physicians described the symptoms of gastric and duodenal ulcers quite precisely. Gastric ulcers caused sharp pain when the patient was hungry and the stomach was empty. It was described as hunger pangs. Once the patient ate, the pain subsided. On the other hand, the patients with duodenal ulcers had no pain on an empty stomach, but the pain started about 2 hours after eating. These symptoms fit in well with the gastric acid theory, and it was explained that the acid in an empty stomach irritated the stomach lining and caused pain. Once it was diluted by food, the pain subsided. On the other hand, the duodenal ulcer pain started a couple of hours after eating, when the food mixed with the acid passed from the stomach to the duodenum. Thus, the acid theory was accepted and remained the valid and most widely acclaimed explanation for peptic ulcers till the mid-20th century. Surgical repair of perforated ulcers became possible from the early 19th century with developments in surgery and anesthesia. But these ulcers were chronic diseases, and the only way to relieve the symptoms was to put the patient on a bland diet and keep them away from too much stress. This caused them to become invalids in the true sense of the word. Soon the surgeons began exploring surgical solutions to reduce acid, as it was thought to be the only way to allow ulcers to heal. But to remove acid from the equation, the only way was to remove the stomach partly or fully. This allowed for the ulcers to heal in many patients, but left them with multiple permanent digestive problems, so much so that they were labeled as gastric cripples. To overcome this issue, instead of removing the stomach, surgeons started to ligate the vagus nerve or the branches of the vagus nerve, which when stimulated caused acid secretion. Thus, peptic ulcers were firmly established as a surgical disease, and the operation theatres and surgical wards were full of these patients. Renowned surgeons from Billroth in 1881 to Lattarget in 1922 developed numerous signature surgical techniques, and surgical luminaries like Moynihan and Mayo published tons of literature on peptic ulcers. Around the 1930s, antacids like calcium carbonate and few aluminum compounds came into the spotlight, as they provided fast relief from the symptoms like heartburn and pain. These antacids work by neutralization of the stomach acid. That is why, despite fast relief, it was not long-lasting, and multiple doses were required daily to keep the symptoms in check. But they were still a better option than undergoing surgery. Surgery now took a backseat and was used only for refractory or complicated cases. In 1976, the drug cimetidine came on the market under the brand name Tagamet. This was the first histamine H2 receptor blocker, which meant that it actually blocked the secretion of acid instead of just neutralizing it. It meant fewer doses and better control of symptoms, and it also meant that by 1979, in just 3 years, it was available in over 100 countries, and it soon became a blockbuster drug, earning more than $1 billion per year. A further extension of Hariwari and Curry principle, patients with ulcers were referred to psychiatrists to be treated with anti-anxiety medication in addition to antacids to decrease their stress levels and hence their acid levels. Though the acid theory was most prevalent, from the beginning of the 20th century, many reports had also been published about the presence of rod-like or curved bacteria in the stomachs of the ulcer patients. Few studies also claimed to have cured the ulcers by the use of antibiotics. But most of the time, these studies were refuted and deemed unreproducible. The bacteria found in the stomach were dismissed as bystanders or bypassers, as it was believed that no bacteria could withstand the high acidity of the stomach long enough to cause an infection. In Australia too, in the 1970s and early 1980s, the norms were pretty much the same. Dr. Robin Warren was a pathologist working at the Royal Perth Hospital. He had been reporting numerous stomach biopsies of ulcer patients, and especially those who were suspected to have cancer. Each time, he found a peculiar S-shaped bacteria in these biopsies, and he did not believe it to be a coincidence. In 1981, a young registrar in the medicine department came to Dr. Warren in search of a project for his third year of residency. He was Dr. Barry Marshall. Dr. Warren gave him a list of the ulcer patients whose biopsies he had seen over 2 years. Dr. Marshall was to look into the clinical findings of these patients. On this list, one of the patients was a woman in her 40s. Who had complained of nausea and stomach pains. But in spite of multiple tests, the doctors found nothing wrong with her physically. So, she was given a psych referral and put on antidepressants. On the other hand, was an 80-year-old man. who came with severe stomach pains. The doctors suspected that there was a decreased blood supply to the stomach. But in those days, there was nothing much that they could do about it. So they just sent him home with painkillers and an antibiotic. To their surprise, the patient was back after 2 weeks, completely hale and hearty. And to Dr. Marshall's surprise, both these patients' stomach biopsies had shown the same peculiar HDF bacteria. He was intrigued, and he decided to take up this project with Dr. Warren. They secured permission from the hospital board to try and isolate these bacteria. They roped in 100 patients, and the trial started in April 1982. Each patient's sample was sent to the microbiology lab to try and culture these bacteria. To their dismay, no bacterial growth was seen in the first 32 patients. But with patient 33 and 34, they hit the jackpot. After the long Easter weekend, Dr. Marshall got a call from the microbiology lab that his cultures had indeed started growing bacterial colonies. He then realized that the lab techs had been discarding the culture plates after 2 days, as was the norm with throat cultures. In throat cultures, after 2 days, the commensal or the bystander bacteria start growing, which makes the culture useless for diagnostic purposes. But these stomach bacteria were slow growing and needed 3 to 4 days, which is what happened over the long weekend. After this, many other patients were also found to have the same bacteria. The duo presented their findings for the first time at the Royal College of Physicians in Perth. But the gastroenterologists, that is the gut specialists, were very skeptical. Dr. Warren and Dr. Marshall weren't deterred. They wrote letters to The Lancet, one of the oldest and the most prominent medical journals. Though their letters did get published, they failed to generate much interest. Dr. Marshall wanted to do a bigger study so that their findings would be better validated and better accepted. But for this larger study, the most important requirement was funds. They approached a number of pharma companies, but the pharma companies were not at all keen on supporting this research, especially when it meant that if this theory was proved to be right, their billion-dollar medicine, Pagamet, was going to become irrelevant. Surprisingly, the doctors were approached by a smaller pharma company that produced a bismuth-containing antacid called Dinel. It was somewhat similar to Pepto-Bismol. This company, in their internal studies, had found that around 30% of the patients treated with Dinel were cured completely and the ulcer never recurred. Sure enough, when Dr. Warren saw the before and after biopsies of these patients, he observed that the bacteria which were evident in the before biopsies had disappeared after treatment with Dinel. So now they had another piece of the puzzle, that these bacteria can be killed by bismuth. With this piece of information, Dr. Marshall presented their findings in a few more international conferences, but he was still met with a wall of skepticism. He realized that the only way to irrevocably prove their hypothesis was to establish a cause and effect relationship. Initially, they tried infecting guinea pigs with a broth of these bacteria, but that was unsuccessful. They needed a human trial, but at this point, it was risky and expensive, not to mention that they did not have the required clearance and permission for the same. This is when Dr. Barry Marshall had a brainwave. The only human that he could experiment on without needing any permission was himself. He had a patient who had been cured by a combination of antibiotics and bismuth. So Dr. Barry took a sample from his culture, whizzled it into a broth and drank it up. Sure enough, in 4 to 5 days, he started waking up with nausea and vomiting. An endoscopic biopsy confirmed that his stomach was teeming with these HDF bacteria. He had successfully established that these bacteria caused gastritis and later showed that he was cured with antibiotics and bismuth. The bacteria were named Helicobacter pylori, helicos meaning helix-like or spiral-shaped, and pylori denoting the area of the stomach which they usually colonize. The findings of this experiment was published in 1985 in the Medical Journal of Australia, and it remains among their most cited articles till date. This daring experiment was expected to get wider recognition for their theory within the medical community. But the medical community was still a bit slow on the uptake. But what did happen was that many newspapers and magazines picked up the story as a human interest piece. Many of them interviewed with Dr. Marshall. As his popularity grew, a number of people came to him for treatment secretly, because antibiotics was still not the treatment of choice as dictated by the medical societies. Ultimately, it was this publicity that forced the NIH and the FDA to sit up and take notice. A number of studies were set up and fast-tracked, and between 1993 and 1996, the whole picture of gastritis and ulcers underwent a sea of change. Now, the recommended treatment is triple therapy, a combination of two antibiotics and antacid which blocks acid production with or without bismuth for a duration of 1 week. The disease, which caused so much morbidity and affected the patient's life endlessly with complications like bleeding and perforation, will now be cured forever with just 1 week's worth of pills. Dr. Warren and Dr. Marshall were awarded the Nobel Prize for Medicine in 2005 for their discovery of Helicobacter pylori and its role in gastritis and peptic ulcer disease. Dr. Warren is now retired from medicine, but Dr. Marshall is still very much active in further research on H. pylori. Many studies about the pattern of H. pylori infection have hypothesized that the increase in cases of gastritis and ulcers in the 19th and 20th century was due to the drastic change in the living and eating habits. There is also a theory which suggests that complete eradication of H. pylori may lead to increased food allergies and autoimmune diseases. Scientists are also studying how H. pylori trains our immune system at a young age and whether it can be used as a vehicle for delivery of vaccine orally. So, the jury is still out on whether H. pylori are a friend or a foe. But Dr. Marshall's self-experiment has certainly become the stuff of scientific lore. After all, the proof of the pudding is in eating it. And remember, children, don't try this at home. Thank you. You are listening to In Historia Medicinae. You can follow us on Instagram. Our handle is A Brief History of Medicine. You can also email us at A Brief History of Medicine @gmail.com.